And welcome to the what should be the regular Sunday night open meeting of the Central Group of AA. Tonight is not the regular open meeting because we have a special event tonight that I think you'll all enjoy. My name is Ed Lee and I'm an alcoholic and I'm substituting for our chairman Ed Wells who can't be with us tonight. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. AA has no dues or fees. Our speaker for the night.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Helen Wynn, and I'm an alcoholic. When I first came to AA, the thing that really gave me the first and immediate release was the knowledge that I was finally diagnosed that I had a disease. That disease is alcoholism. I was told that it was a three-part disease, a disease of the mind or emotions, a disease of the spirit, and a disease of the body. To me, in the time that I have spent in New York, it's come to have four parts. But the aspect of this disease, the physical aspect, is one which I did not concern myself much with because I felt at the time that I first came to AA, and indeed it was true as far as my pattern was concerned, that I had not been very much ravished, as you might say, by the physical aspects. And so I never learned very much about it. Now I find, and I'm sure that that's true for a great many of us, that questions have come up in the last 2.5 years on the physical aspect of it and how it relates to us as a whole, because this is a disease of the whole man. And tonight it gives me extreme pleasure to introduce one of our AA members from San Francisco, Dr. Earle, who will talk on that aspect of this disease of ours. Thank you.
How do you do? My name is Earle, and I am an alcoholic. I was reminded as my daughter and I are here together, and we phoned my wife, who is in San Francisco, and I heard my daughter say that it was getting cold. We took a little drive through Massachusetts and Connecticut, and she said that she was sure that in Great Barrington it would snow tomorrow. And I was reminded of the St. Louis Conference. I think it was on the second night when Bill was talking. And old Ickey Sheridan got up, and he was the chairman of the evening. And Ickey told a story, which I'm going to tell to you. Those of you who were there probably remember it. He said that in East Texas they had a town there, and they had no place to put a drunk if they found him. So they decided they'd put him in the ice house until they could get appropriate quarters for this fellow. And so, sure enough, along came a drunk, and they put him in the ice house. Well, the sheriff was at home having dinner that evening, and he suddenly sat up. And he said, "Oh, Emmy," he said, I left old Joe down there in the ice house. He said, "I got to go and get him out." So he put on his hat and he hightailed it down to the ice house. And he got down to the ice house and he undid the big latch of the door and swung the door open and crouched way over there in the corner with this little old drunk who looked up at the sheriff and said, "For God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death." Jesus Christ. Well, I'm going to talk on the, as you know, there are three aspects of alcoholism. One of them is spiritual. Now, I'm going to take the spiritual aspects of alcoholism and set it over here. Now, I'm not going to talk about the spiritual aspects, although you and I know that this is of great importance. And the third, the second of the three aspects of alcoholism is the emotional aspect. And this I'm going to put over here. And I'm not going to talk about the emotional aspects except those emotions that come from drinking itself. And then I'm going to talk tonight only about the physical aspects of alcoholism. Why it is that you and I become powerless over alcohol, as number one. How this occurs, and number two, why it is that you and I cannot take a drink. Why we must avoid the first drink. We hear this bandied around a great deal. Why is this? Now, much of what I'll say about this whole problem will sound rather pat, as though this were the end, as though this were definite. Well, it is. In this particular day, or on this particular day, in this particular month, and in this particular year. But much of what I say undoubtedly will undergo change as the years go by. In other words, we don't know the absolute answer of how the disease of alcoholism develops from a physical standpoint. But we know a lot about it. Now, I don't treat alcoholism. I'm a surgeon, and I'm not interested in treating alcoholism. But I have availed myself, because of my own problem, of the medical literature that my colleagues have banded together. And this I share with you. Now, as you know, you see, it makes great sense to me that if a person went to a psychiatrist, now it so happens that in my medical training, though I'm a surgeon, I was also trained as a psychiatrist. Now, I don't practice psychiatry, and I never have practiced the private practice of psychiatry. I did in my training, but I never have practiced privately psychiatry. I practice surgery only. But nonetheless, I'm a member of the American Psychiatric Society. And I recall when I first came into AA, someone said there's nothing worse than a confused psychiatrist, you know. At any event, it makes sense to me that when a person has a problem and they go to a psychiatrist, and with sufficient delving, and one finally gets to the realization of what occurred to one, one's problem then subsides. Now, this happens repeatedly in psychotherapy. Now, it makes sense to me that if the alcoholic went to the psychiatrist and discovered what it was that made him drink, that he could then be relieved of the problem of alcoholism and could then drink socially. Now, this makes very good sense to me, you see, in terms of our psychiatric thought. There's only one thing wrong with it, and that is that it doesn't work. It just doesn't work, you see. Now, this doesn't mean in any sense that many of the subsidiary problems that alcoholics have, that perhaps psychiatry can help a great deal, or psychotherapy can help a great deal. But it does nothing for the problem of alcoholism, barring very rare exceptions. Now, what is this problem? How come that you and I have developed the problem of alcoholism? How has this come about? Now, there are 70 million people in the United States who drink. We know this. There are roughly 4.5 million of you and me. 4.5. So we're in the minority, you see. Now, why is it that the alcoholic, why is it that certain people develop the disease of alcoholism and others do not? Well, let's see if we can't investigate this a little bit. Now, first of all, alcohol does not create alcoholism any more than gasoline creates auto accidents. It takes a unique kind of driver, to have the auto accident, and it takes a unique kind of person to develop the disease of alcoholism. Now, what does that mean? We know that there is sufficient evidence, at least, to make us certain that the alcoholic has a physical difference inside of himself which is not shared by the non-alcoholic. We know, for instance, that the alcoholic's utilization of sugar is off the average. And I now talk about the average as though it were non-alcoholic, because they're in the majority. We're in the minority, you see. Our blood sugar at times becomes exceedingly low.
which leads to excessive amounts
of irritability. Now, I'm talking about the sober alcoholic now, not the active alcoholic.
We know that the blood sugar curves in alcoholics show that after the ingestion of sugar, that in a very rapid period, the blood sugar gets very low, much quicker than in the non-alcoholic. Now, also we know that the non-alcoholic is given to periods of low blood pressure. Now, why these are, we don't know. But nonetheless, the periods of low blood pressure, the periods of low blood sugar, which is another way of saying a word that you all have heard, I'm sure, hyperinsulinism, this leads to excessive irritability. Now, it's particularly common in the morning. How many alcoholics have awakened in the morning in attempt to get serenity, and God rest their souls, have sat down with the big book or the Bible or some other spiritual literature in front of them, attempting to get some serenity when they feel like hell. Physically feel awful. Now, there's nothing wrong in reading the big book, of course, or the Bible or spiritual literature. But at this particular time, for many of us, there are other things that are required. Now, I'm not going to go into the treatment of this various business, but nonetheless, don't blame much of the irritability, much of the depression that you feel on the statement, "Oh, good God, I am not on the program. Your blood pressure may be low, or your blood sugar may be low." And with adequate diets and so forth, much of this can be attenuated. Now, we know that the alcoholic has a great requirement for fluids. Now, you know how much coffee that we drink, or tea, or orange juice is tremendous, you see. We can sit down with a pitcher of water and talk to a non-alcoholic, and we'll drink the whole pitcher, while a non-alcoholic will sit there and simply sip at a half a glass of water. Our requirements for fluids are very high. Why this is, we don't know, but it's true. We also know that the alcoholic has a fantastic amount of energy. As an example, the non-alcoholic may be told by his wife to go out and cut the lawn. Now, he may cut the lawn a few strokes at a time, and then he's prodded on by his wife to do it some more, and then he stops and talks to the neighbor. And finally, after a long period of time, the non-alcoholic gets that lawn cut. But let the alcoholic decide to cut that lawn, and it's done just like that, and he's off to five other projects immediately. So, we get no credit for this, you understand, or discredit. This is just the way we are. It's amazing to me when I see this phrase, "take it easy." Now we all know what this means. This is just a way, you know. Alcoholics, whether they've been sober for 150 years, just don't take it easy, that's all. Now, I'm sure that as the years go by and age creeps up on one, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, one is forced to take it easy. On the other hand, this is not in our philosophy as much as we would like to make ourselves feel that it is. So taking it easy is a fine thing, and we do the best we can. But let's not fool our inherent tendencies that this just isn't us. Now, there are some isolated findings, too. There are very few obese, fat alcoholics. Now, I'm talking about sober alcoholics now. There are many fat, active alcoholics. Now, why this is, we don't know. Obesity is far less in alcoholics than it is in the population as a whole. Barring certain exceptions here tonight, baldness is less in alcoholics than it is in non-alcoholics. Now, why this is, we don't know. Now, why do I go about this rather laboriously? Only to point out, there are a couple other things, too. The adrenal gland, which rests on top of the kidney here, and which is one of the key structures as regards our energy, is prone in alcoholics to become suddenly and acutely depleted, leading to great periods of fatigue. This is common in alcoholics. Why this is, we don't know. As a result, one of the treatments for recovery of alcoholism
is the use of adrenal cortical extract, which is used rather commonly.
Because this isn't true only of alcoholics, but it's primarily true of alcoholics. Now, what does all this mean?
This means that we have accumulated a little of the evidence that I have given you, and much more, which I haven't gone into
because there's no point in it. It's technical, and what do we care?
At least the alcoholic is different
from a physical standpoint than is the non-alcoholic.
Now, he gets no credit for this or discredit. This is just the way he or she is.
Now, for want of a better term,
we call this difference, we have named it by
a very common symbol which is used in medical science, the X factor.
The X factor. Now, this was used before insulin was discovered by Banting and Best in Montreal in 1923. What was it that made the diabetic? There was something different about the diabetic. This was called the X factor. What was it? And then we finally found out that this had something
to do with the pancreas and what are known as the islets of Langerhans,
which had undergone degeneration for one reason or another, and therefore the sugar metabolism was upset.
But that's off the point.
We didn't know for many years why it was that certain people had
a tendency, a diathesis, to develop tuberculosis.
This was called the X factor for a long time.
We finally found out that the TB patient was sensitive
to the protein in the capsule around the tubercle bacillus.
This is what the X factor turned out to be.
Now, and so we could go on with many of the diseases. Pernicious anemia, there was the X factor, which has now been isolated. Perhaps someday we will know
what it is that is different about you
and about me. Now, what happens to the person who has this
rather vague, nonetheless
definite, X factor in his or
her body? Well, something of this sort. Now, this is kind of
childish what I'm going to put here, but
you'll see this.
This is
simple psychology. We all undergo periods of tension each and every day.
We undergo periods of tension,
and there's a plateau when we are feeling rather tense,
and a drop-off when we make a decision as to what we're going to do. And so it goes.
Next day the same.
And so, like that.
And many times throughout the day, during a minute,
we undergo these periods of tension.
For instance, you knew about this meeting tonight.
When you first heard about it,
you said to yourself,
shall I go
or shall I not?
There was a little period of tension, and then, God rest your soul, you decided to come. Then there are other things of this sort. What dress will I put on? What tie will I wear? This is quite understandable. Then there may be rather major tensions that will last for years. What profession will I go into? What business will I go into? Well, so this is kind of simple psychology. Now, all people, no, not all people, at least 70 million people in the United States imbibe in the beverage known as alcohol. Now, the non-alcoholic takes alcohol into his body, and it does something for him. I'm sure that alcohol, for the average individual, is a savior of the human race, or one of them. Not so for us. Now, of course, that's gross exaggeration, but at least it does make his life a little simpler, I think. The tongue is loosened up, and he becomes a little more friendly, and the tensions of the day subside, and he has a good time, and perhaps he's the better for it the next day. It's been said that the inhibitions of mankind are alcohol soluble. Well, I think this probably is true. So, when the non-alcoholic is in a period of tension, his tension drops off a little quicker than it does under ordinary circumstances, you see. It relieves tension in all people, alcoholic or non-alcoholic alike. But what happens to the alcoholic who has the X factor inside of him or her? He or she takes alcohol into his or her body, and something unique happens. There is an acute, abrupt drop-off in tension when alcohol is taken in to the body. This seems to radiate his entire system as he takes alcohol into his body. Well, any time a certain substance will do something or do that much for an individual, he will return to it quicker and sooner. Now, any person who drinks enough alcohol, it's felt, in sufficient quantities over a long enough period of time will become an alcoholic. Why aren't all people alcoholics then? They simply don't have the motivation to do this. And here rests the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Alcohol does something for him or her. Now, he returns then to alcohol sooner. Incidentally, the definition of alcoholism by the World Health Organization and the Committee on Alcoholism is as follows, and I quote verbatim. Regardless of why the drinker drinks, now this is irrespective of why he drinks, regardless of why the drinker drinks, it is drink and the results of more drink that make him drink more. Now, regardless of why, this is the World Health Organization definition on alcoholism. Regardless of why the drinker drinks, it is drink and the results of more drink that make him drink more. So you see, it's recognized in medical science that we get caught in a web. What is this web then? Anyone who takes a foreign substance into his body develops a tolerance to it. We might exemplify this way. The tolerance each day grows up until finally it takes this much of the chemical substance to give the same effect that this much used to give. I recall well a good number of years ago operating on a woman who was 73 or 4, as I recall. Now, in this day and age, that's not old. But she looked much older. She looked like a very sweet piece of Dresden china. My own surgical specialty is gynecology, so I have women patients. I operate on her, and because of a rather precarious physical condition, but nonetheless the necessity for operating on her, I gave her a half ounce of brandy to take three times a day. Now, this is good, reputable medical treatment. This woman was a pillar in the Episcopal Church and never in her life had had a drink. Now, I have every reason to believe this sweet soul. I could be wrong, but I'm quite sure she... You know, you can tell somehow. She just somehow, you know. I gave her a half ounce of brandy to create relaxation of her blood vessels. Vascular relaxation, we call this. On the third post-operative day, this sweet piece of Dresden china was up out of bed, stealing the keys from the nurses to get into the liquor cabinet. 3 days. Literally 3 days. Now, this is very, very rare, of course. But it shows that this woman could have gone to her grave with the X factor, never having known it was there, because she didn't ever have the gasoline that creates the auto accident in her system. Well, anyway, tolerance increases. Many of you know, people who are very obese will sit down at a meal and drink and eat tremendous quantities of food. And you often scratch your psychological head and you say, how in God's name do they do it? The same person will then go on a diet and come back to you and say, I don't need that much food because my stomach has shrunk. Well, the stomach hasn't shrunk at all. What's happened is their tolerance to food has decreased. Now, this brings up the problem of sedatives, which are absolute dynamite for the alcoholic. Some of the worst depressions that have been seen are from the modern tranquilizers. Barbiturates. Any of the sedatives of any kind, you and I should avoid like we would avoid the plague. Because, now under controlled conditions, of course, in a hospital, this is a necessary thing at times, postoperatively and so on. But as a means of getting surcease, release, tension, and so forth, it's dynamite because we are a dictable people. Now, I've gotten a little bit off the track. So tolerance, then, increases. I recall well operating on a woman a good number of years ago who was taking 40 grains of morphine a day. 40 grains. Now, this is any individual at rest. A half grain is a lethal or deadly dose. This woman, then, was taking enough to kill any 80 of us, probably all the people here in this room. Well, what had happened to her? Over the course of years, her tolerance to morphine had increased so much that she finally needed this much morphine to give her the same effect that this much used to give her. She had become victimized by an increasing tolerance. Well, now this story is somewhat of an exaggeration if one thinks that she was taking morphine in the black market. Now, this is often watered down by about 3/4. So let's say she was taking only 10 grains of morphine a day. Well, that's still enough to kill only 20 of us. You see, then, what tolerance does. So the alcoholic, then, as he returns to alcohol quicker, because it does so much for him, he gets such tremendous relief, his tolerance daily increases. And we make no mistake about this. As long as the alcoholic drinks, he literally has to have, he must have, ever-increasing amounts of alcohol in any system to get the same effect that he used to get. Now, let's take the body and draw it on the board here as though it were a bucket with a little spigot on the bottom of it. Now, there is the body, roughly, with a little bucket. If we were to pour into that bucket roughly a half to two-thirds of an ounce of whiskey per hour or 8 ounces of beer per hour, one would not get drunk. Two-thirds of an ounce of whiskey or 8 ounces of beer per hour, one would not get drunk. Now, any alcoholic in this audience who is stupid enough to go out and try this will soon find that the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 ounces of alcohol that he will be drinking then per hour, at least, however, one half, two thirds ounce of the eventual 7 ounces that he is drinking will not be involved in getting him drunk, but the other 6.5 ounces will be. So, the alcoholic then cannot stand to linger on two-thirds of an ounce of whiskey per hour or 8 ounces of beer because his tolerance is so high he literally needs more. He's got to get a fluid level into his body. He's got to get a fluid level into his body, and thus develops one of the first symptoms of alcoholism, namely gulping. Now, all of you know so well the cringing feeling that it gives you to go in your active drinking days, if you think back, and see somebody, go to a cocktail party, and see somebody pick up a martini, a non-alcoholic, and bring it to his or her lips and simply sip it. Don't you know? This makes the alcoholic cringe. He says to himself, "Why in God's name don't you drink that thing down?" And then often to make matters worse, this very delightful soul who knows how to drink, you see, will have the temerity to take this martini and sit the damn thing down again on a table. So you see, gulping. Now, I'm going to list these symptoms as they develop. They often develop in different order than this. But nonetheless, this is the average alcoholic develops something like this. Now then, the alcoholic is always around the source of supply. In his own home, if he has a home, and if he has friends in for the evening, if he has friends, and if he has purchased alcohol, if he has the money, He is in the kitchen making the drinks. Now he makes the drinks and puts them on a tray for the people that are in here in the living room. And then he pours himself 2 or 3 ounces in a separate glass and drinks this down, gulps this down, and then takes the tray in to the rest of the people. Oh, this is all right. He thinks nothing about this until someone sees him gulping down these extra 2 or 3 or more ounces and says to him, "What are you doing that for? You've got a drink on the tray." And he says, "I don't know. It just seemed like a good idea somehow." But he senses one thing. There's something cockeyed about what he's doing, and people don't particularly approve of this. So from then on, when he makes his drinks, he puts them on a tray. Then he looks out the door to see if anyone is looking, pours his glass, and quickly knocks it off. He then does this so that not to be caught. Now, later on, he may decide that these friends of his that are coming in are alcoholic, that they're drinking too much alcohol, that he must save them. And so he takes his bottle and he pours out into a big glass, the glass full of whiskey, just so that the supply will seem to be less, so that his friends will not get into trouble. And he takes this glass and he puts it up behind a couple of plates in the cupboard so that it won't be seen. Or later on, he buys, if he's going to the liquor store, an extra pint or an extra Mickey, and you know the fate of these bottles. They will be in the glove compartment or perhaps in the garage or one place or the other. There was always an old cry, you know, some years ago, why didn't the liquor manufacturers make flat fifths? They were always round. Well, you know, you take a round bottle and put it in your drawer underneath the shirts, and when you pull that drawer out, it rattles back and forth. But a flat fifth could lie under the shirts just like a book, you see. Well, anyway, this is a rather long-winded way of stating the alcoholic develops his next symptom, which is sneaking drink. Now, if we took, you or I, a molecule of ether, I'm talking about surgical ether, the kind that we use in hospitals to put people to sleep. Now, we don't use this too much these days. We do under certain circumstances, but ordinarily, no. If we took one molecule of ether and we added to that one molecule of water, we would then have alcohol with this formula.
One molecule of ether plus one molecule of water equals alcohol. So alcohol and ether
are identical, except for this minor difference. Obviously, then, if the drinker whose tolerance is ever increasing has to drink, and I emphasize has to drink, more and more of this alcohol ether, obviously he puts then his brain progressively to sleep, even as though he were getting an ether anesthesia in one of the local surgeries. This leads then to the next symptom, known as blackouts. Now, I'm not talking about passing out, as you know. This is blacking out, where one is on one's feet and awakens the next morning wondering where one was, what one did, or in a strange room or strange bed or God knows where. These symptoms then develop on this basis. Now, up to this point, the authorities say that the alcoholic can be called a toxic dependent drinker with very rapidly slipping control. There are those who say that possibly at this stage of the game, one could stop drinking under his own willpower. Now he's cooked. He could not start drinking again. He can never be a social drinker again. That's gone. We'll discuss that a little bit later. But nonetheless, there are those who say that a few people in this early stage could stop under their own willpower, provided they didn't drink ever again. However, as you know, the big book says that the potential alcoholic or the actual alcoholic, with hardly an exception, can stop drinking and maintain sobriety without spiritual help. So we'll take the authority somewhat with a grain of salt from our own experience. But let's divide this then. Now, from here on, I'm going to talk about toxic dependent drinking, which is a long-winded way of saying you're a drunk. Toxic dependent drinking without control, where willpower is utterly useless, except for a minute at a time. Now, one may say to oneself, I tend to overdo this a little bit, so tonight the boss is coming or there's some important person, I'm going to an important gathering, and I will have only two drinks. Now that's all I will have, and I will stop at the end of two drinks. Now this is a perfectly reasonable request to make of oneself, only to go to the party and then awaken the next morning in a blackout. And one says to oneself, I said I was only going to have two drinks. Or we are acutely reminded of this by our wives or by our husband. You said you were only going to have two drinks, and look what happened. Now, this leads to the next symptom, which is a very dangerous one, and that is getting drunk inappropriately when least planned. So, inappropriate drunkenness. I'll put down inapt D there. Now, the person then awakens about this time in the stage of his alcoholism, and we see now that the alcoholic is slowly becoming cornered by his ever-increasing tolerance and his absolute need for alcohol on the one hand, and utter and complete social disapproval on the other hand. He is being cornered. And the plight of the alcoholic is to fight his way out of this corner by a variety of mechanisms, a fight that he absolutely never wins and always becomes licked by. Now, he awakens the next morning from a blackout, and then he develops one of the first emotional symptoms which comes from the intake of alcohol. Regardless of why the drinker drinks, it is drink and the results of more drink that make him drink more. This is one of the results of more drink. He develops this intense, black, miserable feeling. There's no word that describes it. The word awe may come somewhere near it, but that isn't enough. Terror is insufficient. The word dread is insufficient. This feeling that you all know so well, which becomes our constant companion, is known as remorse. This is something that plagues us endlessly. Remorse, then, becomes one of the next symptoms. Remorse becomes one of the next symptoms. And then about this stage in the game, person starts to develop the shakes and the sweats. Now, we don't know why, medically speaking, that the shakes and sweats develop. There are a lot of theories. One says that the alcoholic's fluid balance is off. Another one says that there is adrenal cortical depletion. The adrenal glands are depleted acutely. Another one says that there is an upset in certain enzyme systems of the body. Some say there's something odd in the midbrain. But irrespective of what causes the shakes and sweats, one thing is for sure. At least half of the shakes and sweats are because the alcoholic is scared half to death of what's occurred the night before and the inappropriate drunkenness and the blackouts and sneaking and the gulping and so forth. And then it occurs to him, if I just had a little bit of the hair of the dog that bit me, I'd be fine. And so then he starts his morning drink. Now, he's telling himself a physiological truth, because alcohol is a sedative, It does quiet down his nerves and does decrease the shakes and the sweats. And it also, number two, appeals to his ever-increasing tolerance. So remorse and the shakes and sweats and the morning drink.
I'll put down here S plus S, that's the shakes and sweats, and the A.M. gulp.
Now, about this time, someone comes to him and says, "Aren't you drinking a little bit more than you used to?" And so he says, "Yes, I suppose so, but I'm a big, strong man, and I can take it." Or the woman says, "Even though I'm small, brother, I'm potent. I can stand it." Now, these people are telling a physiological truth. It is true that because of the increase in tolerance, the woman and man, alcoholic, can literally tolerate more. But this becomes a way of fooling ourselves. We drink because we're strong. We drink for God knows what reason. But we start an endless chain, then, of reasons why we can drink, known as rationalization. So rationalization. Now then, there starts at this time, with acute force, a series of emotional symptoms. Now these emotional symptoms are chemically induced. They are one of the results of the intake of alcohol. They have nothing to do, or very little at least to do, with the same symptom that a person had prior to his stepping across the line of control. Now, one of them is something that becomes our constant companion, a gnawing, a bitter, a fighting feeling that pervades our entire being. Why in God's name don't you leave me alone? And the intense feelings of resentment that fill our hearts are known to all of us. But the one feeling that just fascinates us, literally draws us to it, just something that we love dearly. We hate it, and yet at the same time we need it. It fascinates us like ghost stories do somewhere. And we love to take great big scoopfuls of this sticky business and pour it delightfully all over our entire bodies. We love it. It's known as self-pity. Resentment and self-pity. God, how we love them, don't you know? Well, about this stage in the game, the alcoholic senses that something is really radically different about him. He sees that something is a little bit on the cockeyed side. Well, no one can live for long and live with a sense of personal degradation. One cannot live with a loss of self-respect, self-regard, self-esteem. Now, I don't mean by self-esteem an aggrandizement of oneself, but simply a feeling, of an estimable feeling, I am as good as the next. No better, no less, but as good as. No one, alcoholic or non-alcoholic alike, can live with this feeling. Well, when one finds that one is different, one is getting isolated, one needs, and one does, develop the opposite feeling. I'm not worse than, I am better than. I recall well the self-pity business. To get back to that for 1 minute and lead into the next. There's a hotel in San Francisco known as the Mark Hopkins Hotel. Many of you have heard of that. Well, they used to have, they no longer have it, what was known as the Peacock Court. This was a dance floor. Oh, bigger than this. And so it was a square like this, you know, and the band was up here on a stand, and the dance floor was here. And down here went two rows of tables, and in back there were all kinds of tables, and down on that side went one row of tables. I recall getting off by myself many, many times and sitting at this table, and on this wall there were great, big, long windows which overlooked San Francisco. And I would sit at this table with a glass in my hand, all alone, and look out at out that window with my eyes half closed, and envision that the dancers and the people at all of these tables would say to themselves, "My, look at that lonely man." Don't you know? And then to slowly, very slowly, get up and take my glass, walk down the aisle and not look at any of the faces, but just slightly over their heads, and walk down and walk down this place. And so the alcoholic senses something is different, and so he goes into a bar, and he sits on a bar stool, and he immediately checks on his friends, confreres. They aren't not friends, but they're there. He looks over, and he sees this guy, and he deduces that he must be a newly hired janitor, not even an old hand. And he sees the fellow on this side, and he's sure that he must be an apprentice carpenter. But believe me, Einstein sits in the middle. Always in the middle. And so this feeling of that comes out of a sense of loss of personal worth takes the opposite track. How many times the alcoholic has said to himself, "God rest his soul, I have heard that there is a second coming of Christ, and I wonder." Now, so he develops then this rather godlike mechanism. All right, so here we are. This guy, you see, is getting more and more into trouble. Now let me say again that he's becoming victimized by his ever-increasing tolerance on the one hand, his need for more and more alcohol all the time, and utter and social disapproval on the other hand. And he's trying to fight his way out of this corner, and he ain't doing very well. Now, I'm going to erase this little body bucket here from the board. Now, if we continue this formula up here, alcohol, and we took one molecule of alcohol and we added to that two molecules of carbon dioxide. That's the business that we breathe out when we exhale. If we added to one molecule of alcohol two molecules of carbon dioxide, we would then have ordinary table sugar. So table sugar, alcohol, and ether are identical except for these very, very minor differences.
One molecule of alcohol plus two molecules of carbon dioxide, CO2, equals sugar. So sugar, alcohol, ether are identical except for those minor differences. Now, what does this mean?
This means, then, that the active drinker, as he takes large amounts of this sugar into his body, he satisfies perhaps his caloric requirements. He may oversatisfy them and become fat, for that matter. But he gets no protein, he gets no fat, he gets no minerals, and no vitamin equivalents. He then very quickly, or sometimes slowly, develops malnutrition. Well, you add malnutrition and the symptoms of malnutrition, let alone the emotional symptoms of malnutrition on top of this business, and you're really getting yourself a mess. Let's take just one deficiency, vitamin B2 deficiency. Now, it'll make a difference why or how a person becomes depleted in vitamin B2. Can be from simple starvation, can be from some acute illness. But let's just make it alcoholism for our sake tonight. The symptoms of acute vitamin B2 deficiency are a sense of marked emotional instability. A sense of crying easily occurs, very, very easily. A sense of impending doom, a sense of impending disaster. Now, maybe many of you feel some of these symptoms here tonight don't deduce that you're necessarily in vitamin B2 deficiency, though you might be. I don't know. But nonetheless, the alcoholic develops these rather acutely. Imagine these symptoms marked. So just simple vitamin B2 deficiency.
So, I'll just put down the word mal. That means malnutrition occurs.
And we already mentioned vitamin B2.
So one sees
how chemically induced emotional symptoms develop. Now this godlike business, the self-pity, the resentments, the remorse, the symptoms of malnutrition, you see, have nothing to do with the alcoholic's pre-alcoholic personality. Everyone feels resentment. Everyone feels self-pity. Everyone at times, when esteem is low, will resort to aggrandizement, that sort of business. I had it today. I went to the hotel here, and here I'm a physician, licensed to practice one of the greatest states in this country. And I went to the manager, and I said I wanted to cash a check. And he said, "Do you have any credit here?" And I said, "No." I said, my travel bureau wrote ahead that I could sign a check for my bill. He said, "Yes, you can do that, but you can't cash a check here." Why? I felt like, I said to myself, "You can't talk to me that way. I am a doctor." Don't you know? Now, I didn't say this to the fellow. I took it easy for a minute. But I did say, "Well, yes, I can understand that," and walked away. But I told my daughter about it when we got outside. And finally, I realized, you see. So everyone feels these things, you know. But nonetheless, the texture of this godlike business, self-pity business, resentment, remorse, and so forth, is different than it was before we became alcoholics. This is true of any disease. The symptoms of an acute fever, of a very debilitating disease, people develop fantastic emotional symptoms as they are quite ill. Once they recover from the illness, these symptoms disappear. How often have we seen a horrible mess come to the first meeting of AA, and within a couple of weeks or two, you don't recognize the fellow. He's better. He says he's feeling much better than he ever felt before. He has convalesced to some degree from this chronic disease known as alcoholism. So, malnutrition. Now, alcohol, like all sedatives, reverses its action finally. Alcohol, to begin with, stimulates appetite. It reverses this action. So that while originally a person may drink and stimulate his appetite, finally it depresses his appetite. And while originally the alcoholic may have taken a drink so that he could get a few hours sleep, he finally has insomnia, and he drinks more so that he can go to sleep, and he's wider awake. And he drinks more so he can get drunk, and he can't get drunk, and he can't sober up, and he's suspended between nothing and nothing. Now, so that insomnia and loss of appetite, which make all of these symptoms become more pronounced as this ever-increasing tolerance goes on and utter and social disapproval occur on the other hand. So I'm going to put down here minus A and minus S, minus appetite and minus sleep. All right, so here we are. Now, the alcoholic then says to himself, people are talking to him about his drinking, and he doesn't want to hear the word. Can't stand to be told, talked about alcohol. Don't talk to me about it at all. He gets mad every time someone mentions alcohol. He keeps it to himself. He never says anymore that he drinks more than the ordinary person. He gets to a stage. He keeps this from people. He hates the word. He becomes fighting mad if someone mentions that he's drinking more, and this sort of business goes on. And then finally he develops something that many alcoholics know so well. And that is, he says, good God, who wouldn't drink in New York where there are so damn many tall buildings? Who wouldn't drink where you've got to take a subway? Who wouldn't drink when you have a job like that? Who wouldn't drink when you have a wife like this? But what I'll do is that I'll go to Denver. It's not so humid there. It's dry. It's high. And I'll get away from all these tall buildings and all these jobs and all these wives and so forth. And so he goes to Denver, but he takes New York with him, you see. And then he says, well, it's too high and dry here. Ah, the place I'll go, frivolity, fun is what I want. I don't like this high drive business. I didn't like those tall buildings. I'll go down to where things are all beautiful, lovely colors, flat buildings, don't you know, frivolity and gaiety. I'll go to Los Angeles. And so he goes to Los Angeles, but the poor soul takes New York and Denver with him to Los Angeles. And so finally, we realize that we are the last person to recognize that the problem is not New York and not Denver and not Los Angeles and not our wives and not our jobs. It's ours somewhere. So the geographical cure business goes on. We know this so well. Now, at this point, these are roughly the symptoms on top of toxic dependent drinking with rapidly slipping control. The next block here, toxic dependent drinking without control. And now comes the final stage of true addiction. Now, at this point, the only thing that is important to the alcoholic is that he get another drink. Alcohol becomes the most important thing in his life. He does not try to save face. He divorces wife. He quits jobs. He's in many, many jails. The only thing that's important is that he find another drink of alcohol. Now, so we'll put down here the chemical formula for alcoholism is ROH. So I'm going to write ROH here with an exclamation mark after it, meaning this is what we want.
So, ROH.
Now, at this time, he may end up in hospitals, repeated arrests, getting arrested, getting out of jail, and in 10 minutes drunk again, back into jail and getting out, and it's just an endless chain. And some people, as you know, have 50, 100, 150 arrests and get drunk immediately they come out. So jails and hospitals become the constant companion of the alcoholic. Now, jails and hospitals can occur way up there in the gulping stage, or way here in the remorse stage. I mean, a difference, but they're very common at this stage. We'll put down here J and H. J equals H can be here, or it can also be there. And finally, we get down to where there are DTs, and finally Korsakoff syndrome, and finally death. All right. So this then is the fate of alcoholism, which is an ever-progressing disease. Now, what happens in this business? Let me just put a parallelogram here on the board. Now, let's put all the symptoms of alcoholism here. Gulping, all the way down here to death. Those are all the symptoms. And this triangle is abnormal drinking. This is normal drinking. Now, this is the line of control. That's the line of control. That line that you and I know so well, that some remember rather definitely, some remember rather vaguely. May occur in a very short period of time, may occur over the course of several years. It comes on so slowly. But as soon as that first symptom, any one of these, develops, one can say one is over the line of control. And although very early in the game, it might be, I question this, but it might be that one could stop drinking under one's willpower, the very first symptom or two. One would have to maintain permanent sobriety. One can never go back to social drinking. This is something that one has completely and totally given up. Now, usually it takes somewhere between 10 and 15 years for the disease of alcoholism to develop. Now, let's put down here 15 years. Now, I told you about one case where it took 3 days. There are some it takes 30 or 40 years, some 20, some 10, some 7, some 1, some 16, so on. But the average is 15 years from the first drink here to stepping over the line of control. Once one has stepped over the line of control, one develops these symptoms, and that is how, as far as is known today, or as far as I have been able to glean out of the medical literature, how you and I, from a medical, physical standpoint, become powerless, progressively so, over alcoholism. Now, a person may be, for instance, in this stage. Right there, 90% of his drinking is normal, and 10% is abnormal. Or he may be here. 50% of his drinking is normal, and 50% is abnormal. Or he may be there on Skid Row, where 95% of his drinking is abnormal, and 5% is normal. In other words, the Skid Row alcoholic has enough control left to stop and bum a dime to get a jug of Muscat wine. So control as such is never completely lost until one dies. It's a gradual slipping business. But you and I come to a point in our drinking career where we have lost as much control as we can afford to lose and still maintain our own integrity. This, then, is the bottom that you have reached and I have reached, and the two are not comparable. One cannot compare the bottom that each alcoholic has come to. Some may come to this bottom, some may come to this bottom, and some may go to this bottom. Now, only 5, at most 10%, as far as is known, of alcoholics ever reach Skid Row. 90%, the forgotten alcoholic, is the alcoholic with assets, the one who has a home, has a family, children, money in the bank, and a car in the garage. Many, many alcoholics of this kind. This is a progressive... Alcoholism is like pregnancy. Either you are or you aren't, you see. But you can be either 2 months pregnant and not show, or one can be bulging in all of one's maternal delightfulness and show all over the place, but either woman is just as pregnant as the other. And I'm sure you'll forgive that physiological simile, metaphor. That's the way it goes. Now, this is like, once one gets to this point, if one continues to drink, one inevitably goes in this direction. Barring, without exception, one goes in that direction. Now, why do we say that though we understand a little bit now of how we become powerless over alcohol, and all I'm talking about tonight is the first half of the first step, what do we mean when we say we can't take the first drink, or the first drink makes us drunk? This is physical nonsense for most alcoholics. It isn't one drink that makes us drunk. Actually, we don't take a drink and fall drunk on the floor. That's not what we mean, and I'm sure you all know this, but let's just say assurance and repetition. It simply means that once we take a drink into our body, we start up almost immediately all of these symptoms, which may have taken us 15 years, or maybe 1 year, or maybe 30 years, to develop to begin with. It means it's like the hay fever sufferer who may live 30 years around primrose or ragweed and never sneeze, but comes a day when he crosses the line of control and his bodily mechanism develops a sensitivity or an allergy to the substance and he starts to sneeze. Forevermore, when he is around these substances that he's allergic to, he will start to sneeze practically instantly. Within a few days or a few weeks, he will start to sneeze. His disease process then starts instantly, while it took years to develop to begin with. We can't take one single drink without all of our symptoms falling right on our head almost immediately. Within a few days, a few weeks, some alcoholics have even gone back and done what they say was social drinking for a matter of 6, 7, 8 months or a year. But nonetheless, they develop all the symptoms, the same rat race starts again, and it took them at least 15 years or so to develop it in the first place. So this is what we mean. We must avoid the first drink, because if we don't, these symptoms will come on us. We'll be taken suddenly acutely drunk right off the bat. Now, what do we do? You can't take alcohol out of a man's life and without leaving a great big hole in it, who has been used to drinking for years. What do we do then? AA doesn't tell him how to stop drinking. It tells him how to keep from starting again. And you take alcohol out of this man's life, and you've left a great big hole in his life. What's he going to do? We fill this by what we call Alcoholics Anonymous. This, then, is what we plug this hole with. That meant so much to us. We become as dependent on Alcoholics Anonymous as we were once dependent on alcohol. We need, our tolerance to AA increases as time goes by without the social disapproval. Some places even social disapproval, you know. Like the fellow said, good God, I'd sober up before I joined that damn bunch. So, I'm not going to belabor this whole business, but I am going to say this. You know the AA program in your own way, just like you became an alcoholic in your own way. Now, AA is something that we owe debts of gratitude to people that we can never pay. It's impossible for us to repay what people have given us in the development of our program. And I know that Bill feels the same way. We cannot repay the physician, the doctor, for the endless hours that he has, and the endless amount of time and energy that he has given to us. And teaching us something about nutrition, about diets, about the various things he's done for us. The books that he has written, the symposiums he's had about us, the worries that we have given him. We cannot repay the physician. And yet the physician cannot give us the kind of sobriety that we have to have. It's impossible. And the psychiatrist, you see, as much as he is meant to the development of this program, we can never repay these debts, you see. The psychiatrist who has talked to us and put us on an endless series of couches and tried to understand why we do what we do, you see. The debt of gratitude that we owe the psychiatrist, we absolutely can never repay. And yet, the psychiatrist has not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we have to have. It's impossible. And so the clergy, God rest their souls, they have the men of the cloth, you know, they have given endlessly of their time and of their lives. They are, their principles are the very basic tenets of our program. And yet, single-handedly, the clergy, as much as we owe them, we never can repay them. They, barring very few exceptions, have not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we have to have. And yet, you can take a bunch of arrogant, idealistic, perfectionistic, egotistical blockheads who have become victimized by the disease of alcoholism and get them together in a bare hall like this, and they stay sober. Now, why is this? Why is this? What is this power? What is the thing that you possess? I can see it in your eyes right now. As I look out there, right at each one of you, I can see it as I look out around this room. What is it that you possess that these other great men, simple dopes as all of us are, these great men cannot give us? What is it that we have? What is it that Alcoholics Anonymous possesses? What is this power that you have? Well, I don't know what it is. I suppose the doctor might call it psychosomatic medicine. But this is insufficient. I suppose that the psychiatrist might call it benevolent interpersonal relations. I suppose that he might even call it group psychotherapy. And I suppose that there are those who might describe this power that you possess as esprit de corps. Esprit de corps. But the power that I can see in you right this very minute, and which is maintaining your sobriety and my sobriety, to me, is the very essence of God. Thanks very much.
We all feel about this, but we do have a secretary's announcement, and then afterwards there's going to be a question and answer period, and you'll all have a chance to ask Earl all the questions I know you're buzzing with. So we have the secretary's announcements first, please.
Good evening, and welcome to the regular Sunday night open meeting of the Central Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much, Dr. Earle, for bringing this wonderful meeting to us. Next week we have the Manhattan Group here, and before that, at 7:30, the beginners' meeting, which will be led by someone, as usual. Again, I'll make an announcement about the dinner, which is November 11th. That's Bill's 23rd anniversary at the Astor. If you've never been, it's a wonderful experience. See 1,500 or 2,000 drunks, sober, and having a good time. The speakers are Stuart North of White Plains, Mary McMahon of Lenox Hill, and Bill himself, of course. We have three tables reserved, and I believe there are a few seats left at the third table if you want to get your reservations and your money in. At the back, we have free literature. The big book is $4.50. The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, $2.75. And we have the new book, AA Comes of Age, which is $4. The Grapevine is 35 cents. If you don't have enough money and you want one of these books, we'll be very happy to make arrangements for you to pay it on time. If there are any new people here who would like to become a member of this group, I'd be very happy to see you afterwards, or anyone who wants to be put on the active list. Let's see. And also, if there's anyone new or visiting here, my name is Avril Gentles. I'm the alcoholic secretary, and I'm tall and wearing a red dress, so you can probably find me, and I'll be happy to introduce you to other members. We have no dues or fees, but we have a very expensive cake with icing, and if you can help us. Thank you very much.
Life.